Father, we thank you for this time we have together. And as we think about the influence of your word and your spirit and your people upon society, now we pray for your wisdom and for your understanding. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. We have been looking at what Schaeffer regarded as various examples of accommodation. And the one we spent our time on last session was on what we called slipping morality. And then I think we had a helpful discussion about two kinds of problems. The one where we regard the present culture as our authority in moral issues, and the other, in answer to Roberto's question, where we regard the traditional culture as being equivalent to biblical teaching and become subject to the authority of traditional culture rather than the authority of Scripture itself. Now today I want to move on to the next point, which I think is point number 12. We'll make this our last one. This is getting rather too long here, these number of points. But point number 12 is what I've called the devaluation of Reformation influence and Christian influence in general on the culture. That is really the denial that Christians have had any serious impact on the law, the moral values, the institutions of a Western culture. On page 384 of volume 4 in Schaeffer's Complete Works, A Christian View of the Church, in The Great Evangelical Disaster, Schaeffer deals with this issue. He's speaking about the influence of the Reformation on European and Western society in general, and then the influence of the Reformation heritage on the founding of the United States, and in other ways on the political and social structures of various Western European and American and so on cultures. And Schaeffer writes this: "There are those within evangelical circles today who would, under the guise of scholarship, belittle all of this and act as though the Christian consensus was always in a total muddle. Just how far this can be taken may be shown by the example of one Christian historian who carries the muddle all the way back to the Reformation itself." He writes, "Schaeffer's confusion rests on his inability to see Protestantism as the religious form of Renaissance humanism. To be sure, Protestants said that their consciences were informed by the Bible, on which authority alone rested, sola scriptura. Yet we all know of Protestant inability to agree on what the Bible said, or even on what kind of a book it is. In his triumphalism, Schaeffer cannot see the ironic and tragic in the Protestant movement, because he refuses to see it as an aspect of the humanist movement itself. In his various works, Schaeffer repeatedly invokes the Reformation as the answer to the problem of humanism, when in reality it is part of the problem." Now, Schaeffer then goes on to comment on this issue. But it's obvious from, if you read How Should We Then Live, for example, or see the films, or if you read Schaeffer's Christian Manifesto, he was very profoundly convinced that Protestant Christianity had an enormous impact on the life of Western Europe and on the life of the United States, and on the development of its political and cultural institutions. Now, Schaeffer gives this one example here of a devaluation of this notion, but that is that kind of devaluation or attack on the notion of any kind of Christian influence on Western culture is one that one will find repeatedly. I remember reading a review of the How Should We Then Live series, I think written by Jack Rogers from Fuller Seminary, in which he attacked this idea very, very strongly that the Reformation had had this kind of profound impact on Western society that Schaeffer suggested. But it's a criticism that you'll find very often made. Now, it's important, it becomes particularly important in the discussion at the moment that's going on in the United States about the political structures and the moral values of this culture. But I want to just make some points here about what Schaeffer was saying. First of all, Schaeffer was not arguing that there was a golden age, either after the Reformation in Western Europe, in say Switzerland or Holland or Scotland or England or Germany. He was not arguing that there was a golden age, nor was he arguing that there was a golden age at the time of the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, etc. When Schaeffer writes about the Reformation, or speaks about the Reformation, he readily acknowledges mistakes that the Reformers made. For example, of their tying state and church too closely together, of Luther's attitude to the peasants' revolt, where he encouraged the nobles to smite, stab, and slay the peasants, and also of their failure to take up the challenge of missions beyond Europe. And you could find other points as well, where Schaeffer points out some of the inadequacies of the Reformation. So Schaeffer wasn't arguing that there was a perfectly Christian past, or that where Christians have influenced society, that everything they did was good, or that they really created a culture which one could call completely Christian. So that's the first point. The second is this, that Schaeffer was not arguing either that all people, or even the great majority of people, were at one time real Christians, either in Western Europe after the Reformation, or in the United States at its founding. Rather, what he was arguing was that there was at one time a consensus of opinion in, say, Switzerland or Holland or England or the United States at its founding, a consensus of opinion which was shaped by a biblical worldview. And I want to make several points here that are fundamental to that biblical worldview, which affect the nature of a society. One would be that there is indeed a God in heaven, a God who exists, to whom we are answerable. Secondly, that we live in a created universe, a world made by this divine being, with an order to it and structure, which can be examined and understood. Thirdly, that there is a moral order in this universe, a moral order which finds its source in God, that good stands over against evil. Fourthly, there is what Schaeffer would call antithesis, that is, that truth stood over against falsehood. And again, this notion of antithesis found its source in God. fifthly, that there is a morally accountable human race. That there were absolute distinctions between good and bad behavior. A morally accountable humanity with distinctions between good and bad behavior, and between innocence and guilt. That there was such a thing as objective guilt before God. Six, that all human beings stand on level ground before God. All are made by him in his likeness. And seven, that people or human beings are sinners and need restraints on their sin. Now those 7 points, and one could add others to them, but those are fundamental. Those were the consensus of opinion in Western Europe after the Reformation and in North America at its founding as a nation. It's not that everyone was Christians, that's not the point. But the vast majority of people held these views. Now, holding those views, and holding them not as religious truth over here, in the way that people might do today, but holding them as the truth about what is and who we are, had a very profound effect upon the kind of societies which developed. And let me make several points here. What did these give, this consensus of opinion give? It gave several things which are a tremendous blessing to the human race. The first is the notion of the rule of law. That is, that there is a law given by God which rules all human beings and every human society. Now that is very important, because much of the human race has been ruled by the notion that might is right, that whoever is in power is the law. Wherever biblical Christianity has had any influence on a culture, it has given this gift, that there is a rule of law, which comes from God himself, which stands over all people. A second consequence of this is, therefore, accountability. The accountability of those who govern. That is, they stand under the law too, just like the peasant and the prince, the peasant and the president, the ordinary man and woman in the street, and those in Congress stand equally under the law. They are accountable to God, they're accountable to the law. Indeed, that they are accountable to the governed as well. Thirdly, the notion of truth, that there is truth which can be found, which ought to govern a society and its people. And every discipline. That because this is a created universe, it can be examined and understood. That is, again, that truth can be found. This is God's world. We can study it and examine it. In other words, this is the foundation for science, we might say. And science hasn't developed in all cultures, because many cultures do not have a notion of an objectively existing created order which has a rational structure to it, which man can understand. but where Christianity has shaped the consensus, there is that confidence that truth can be found, that there is a world that can be examined and understood. Fourthly, this Christian consensus, or Judeo-Christian consensus, has within it a democratic impulse. That is, if all people are significant before God and stand on a level plane before Him, then all people ought to have some say in their government. As I said before, those who govern are accountable not only to the law, but they are accountable to those who govern them. I mean, they are rather accountable to those who are governed. So there is a democratic impulse within a biblical understanding of the human person. What have I got to? Number five? Okay, five. Another consequence of this view is the notion of restraint on those in power. Because there is the recognition that everybody is sinful, there is also the recognition that power corrupts people, and therefore there have to be restraints on human authorities, that only God's authority is absolute. All human authority is derived, accountable to Him, accountable to the people, and because of the sinful tendency of the heart, power will corrupt people, and there must therefore be checks and balances. Separation of powers, restraints on those in power, however we want to express it. And then, sixth, again, the notion of objective guilt, of human responsibility, that people are accountable for what they do before God, before the society, before one another. And there is objective guilt, which can be punished, which ought to be punished. Now, there are many other things one could say as well, but these are some of the fundamental gifts, one might say, of a Judeo-Christian worldview to a culture. And this is really what Schaeffer is arguing, that there was, after the Reformation, there was in Northern Europe, in Northern America, at the time of its founding, a consensus of opinion shaped by a biblical worldview, which deeply affected the institutions and understanding of the society. Thirdly, this is coming to back to the things, the main points here. First, he wasn't arguing there was a golden age. Secondly, he wasn't arguing that all people were Christians. Thirdly, Schaeffer was not arguing either that all the founders of the USA, of its constitution, of its declaration, were personally Christians. He knew very well that some of them were deists and rationalists. But even though they were deists and rationalists, some of them, not all of them, because some were Christians, they were indeed shaped in their thinking too by a Christian worldview. When you look back at people like Thomas Jefferson, for example, it is important, if you say this man was a deist or this man was a rationalist, it is important not to regard him as a 20th century rationalist. A 20th century rationalist in 1990 doesn't believe that there is truth to be found, doesn't believe there is a moral law in the universe, does not believe in sin. Jefferson was not a 20th century man. He was not a Christian. But he wasn't a 20th century man. His understanding too of the world was shaped by a Christian worldview. and profoundly believed that there was truth to be found, that there is a moral law in the universe, that there is sin which needs restraint, etc. In addition, to their own thinking being shaped by a Christian worldview, these men recognized the consensus around them that it was Judeo-Christian and appealed to it. And as Oz made this point over and over again in his lectures this past weekend, they understood that this republic would only flourish and endure with a religious underpinning, with the underpinning of that Judeo-Christian worldview and morality. Now that's important, because when you look at somebody like Jefferson and you say this person was a deist or this person was a rationalist, don't understand them in a 20th century context. Point number four, it was the loss of this consensus, this Judeo-Christian consensus, that made Schaeffer so concerned for the future of this nation and the future of Western Europe. He pointed out over and over again that what remains now in our culture is the notion of freedom, but just of what he called merely freedom, or bare freedom. Freedom without any definition of what it means, freedom without a sense of moral obligation or moral accountability to God and one's fellow human beings. But now we have the pursuit of freedom for its own sake. And Schaeffer felt, if you've seen How Shall We Then Live, you'll see how he makes this point very strongly in episodes 9 and 10, that it is this belief or pursuit of merely freedom which he regarded as the hammer blow which will destroy this culture. That freedom without responsibility, freedom without a sense of moral obligation, is totally destructive to a culture. What it creates is a society which has to have more and more government to control it. And we see that all around us. Because you have to replace people's sense of obligation, people's sense of responsibility to God, to one another, to the society, with more and more rules and laws and more government officials in every controlling every sphere of life. And the more just excessive freedom you get, the more power has to be given to those in authority. Germany in the early 1930s gives us a very instructive example of a society which had become extremely decadent, which pursued freedom without any kind of form. And the reaction to that was Hitler. A man is seen as one who would provide that structure which was missing within the society. So Schaeffer was very afraid about the future on the basis of the loss of consensus. Now, he wasn't a pessimist, because he believed that there was a sufficient, we might say, interest in the economic sense, a sufficient interest from the Judeo-Christian consensus of the past to appeal to in people and to work on as a basis on which to call people back to that consensus and to the gifts that it gave. That brings me to point number five. Why is this important? Why is it important? Why was Schaeffer so concerned about the denial by Christians of any positive influence from the Reformation, or of any positive influence of Christians at any point in our past, on the development of this culture? Why did he think it mattered? I think there are several reasons here as I thought about this. One is that it undercuts the need for Christian involvement today. If you suggest that Christians in the past have had no influence, it seems to devalue the importance of Christians seeking to have some influence today. If when they held more of the consensus they had no influence, what chance do we have? And one might say more fundamentally, secondly, it appears to deny, this view appears to deny, that God has been active in history, at least in the lives of nations, since the New Testament era. It appears to suggest that even when there were many Christians, that God was not able to enable them to be any impact, any salt and light in the society in which they lived. So it seems to remove God from the arena of society. Thirdly, such a view appears to accept a sacred secular division, that the concern of Christians is only for some narrow, sacred realm, rather than that we have a calling to influence the culture in which we live, wherever we live, at any moment in history. And related to that, fourthly, it appears to suggest that there is different truth in different areas. Again, that Christian truth is something which only affects the individual as a person, rather than something which affects the lives of nations, social structures, political structures, economies, law, etc. One should note, incidentally, that a great many non-Christian historians don't hesitate to acknowledge that Christianity had a huge impact on the development of this particular culture. I always remember reading a book, a fascinating book, by Jeremy Rifkin, who was one of the radicals in the 60s. It's called The Emerging Order, God in the Age of Scarcity. It's a book written in the 70s, in which he, though he is not a Christian, he looked back at the history of the United States and saw that at every point of crisis in this society, there had been an evangelical revival which had been the impetus for the radical transformations that came about to really shape this culture. And he was looking at evangelical Christianity today as the only source of hope for providing a basis for dealing with environmental problems, the problem of the environment in which we live, because Christianity has within it fundamentally a notion of human beings as God's stewards of this creation, rather than simply as exploiters of the world in which we live. And again, this is a non-Christian writing, but you would find in many, many different contexts the acknowledgement of Christian influence on the development of this particular culture, or the culture of Western Europe. Now, does anyone have any questions here at all? I've got through quite a bit of material there, and there's some very important points in all this. But this is one of the areas where Schaefer's thinking is particularly under attack at the moment. Yeah.
Could you just go over the 5 points one more time, just the basic 5 points?
One, he was not arguing there was a golden age. Those ones you mean?
Yes, please.
Yeah. One, Schaefer was not arguing that there was some Christian golden age, either at the Reformation or at some point in America's past. He was ready to acknowledge the mistakes that were made, the lack of consistency at all sorts of points. Secondly, he was not arguing that all people were Christians individually, i.e. born again, but that there was a consensus of opinion which was shaped by a biblical worldview. And then all the points under that. Thirdly, he wasn't arguing that all the founders of this nation were individually Christians. He recognized some were deists and rationalists, but would have said they were shaped by the Christian worldview. They weren't 20th century rationalists. Fourthly, the loss of this consensus, this Christian consensus, or Judeo-Christian consensus, was what made him very concerned for the future of this nation and of Western Europe. Incidentally, Solzhenitsyn makes exactly the same point. If you read his Harvard address from several years ago now, I've got copies of that if you're interested. I handed out to one of my classes last semester. He makes exactly the same point about the understanding of freedom and the loss of a sense of obligation in our culture, and he argues very strongly that that sense of obligation before God, this is Solzhenitsyn now, is what shaped the whole development of Western democracies. And fifthly, why is this important? This whole notion that Schaefer, where Schaefer suggests that Christians did indeed influence the development. Yeah,
Clay. Most right-wing.
Yeah, the question is there indeed enough of a consensus to stop the society breaking down? That's a very difficult question to answer, but I would say there's enough of a consensus to appeal to people still. If you consider Oz's lectures this weekend and the work he did on the Williamsburg Charter, he attempted there to contact Protestants, Roman Catholics, Jews, Muslims, humanists, people right across the board religiously, to come to the defense of the religious liberty clause. And the way he did that work, if you look at the Williamsburg Charter, it carries with it the notion of respect for other people, and a sense of obligation to other people as well as to oneself. This week he's actually at a non-Christian college dealing with this issue, and it is a very serious problem. You've probably read articles in the press about what's called the sensitivity issue on college campuses, how people on the left have prevented people on the right from speaking. They say, what you're saying, if you're from the right, is offensive to minorities, it's offensive to women, it's offensive to this group, it's offensive to that group, therefore you're not allowed to say anything. And this has created a real problem. And a couple of universities here in the States who recognize that they have lost the freedom of speech because of this, such a concern for sensitivity that then you end up, nobody's able to saying anything controversial at all. But it is a kind of tyranny, actually, which prevents anybody saying anything. Not that people shouldn't be sensitive, of course they should. And you know, you look at some of the we won't mention any names, but you look at some of the adverts in the political race a few weeks back, and some of them were absolutely shameful in terms of appearing unashamedly to racist tendencies in people when it came up to the election. So sensitivity is important, yes, but sensitivity must not be used to deny the freedom of speech. And Oz was invited by a couple of college presidents, and that's where he is this week, giving lectures on this issue, and the president of one of the colleges wrote to every member of the faculty, administration, the whole student body, and personally encouraged them very strongly to come and hear him. because he recognizes that something very profound is happening once you lose freedom of speech in a culture. And hopefully there will be enough of a consensus there to appeal to. If you can help people to see what they're doing and how precious the notion of both freedom of religious expression is and freedom of speech in a society, I think there is still something there to appeal to, but it's getting less and less. That is the problem. That's why I very carefully used the expression that you could say, if you like, you've got capital. The capital would be those Judeo-Christian notions of who God is, who we are, the reality of sin, the existence of truth, of good and evil, etc., etc. That's the capital. The interest, if you like, is the points that gives. That there is a rule of law. Or that you need checks and balances, you need restraints on those in power. Those are the interest which comes from the capital of a Christian consensus. Now, I think we would have to say, where probably the majority of the people are concerned, or perhaps the majority, I mean it's difficult to know figures, that the capital has gone. What you're left with is the interest. Most people, if you push them, would say they still believe in a rule of law, though actually there's a real tension, and we talked about this in Christian Responsibility in Society. If you talk to the average American man and woman, you would get double answers here. You'd get ambiguous answers. If you ask them about this, they would probably give a mixture of answers, depending on what question you ask them. If you ask them certain questions, they might say, well, what is basic in our society is the freedom of the individual to choose. That is, that law comes from the individual person. If you ask them different kinds of questions, they might say, well, it's really a question of democracy, and by democracy they would understand what the majority think. So we ought to have a referendum on it. It ought to be on our ballots. What do the majority of the people think? What is the consensus? Do they think that homosexuality is right, or do they think it's wrong? Do they think this is right, or do they think that is wrong? And so you'd get people appealing both to the freedom of the individual and to the majority opinion as their basis for law. But if you ask them other questions, if you push them a little bit, you would find most Americans would still say that a rule of law is necessary, that there really are objective moral standards and legal standards which ought to govern everybody, from the president down to the person on the street. I would say we are in a situation where these two views, the one which is based on the human person as the source of law, the other as God as the source of law, even at the level of interest, are, never mind at the level of capital, are in real conflict with each other. But I think most people, if you help them to see what that leads to, will opt for this, even without a basis for it. The same in other areas, it would be more obvious. If you started talking about restraints on power, because power corrupts, because people are sinful, if you worded it rightly, you would get everybody to agree with you almost immediately. While people might say in theory that people are really basically good, that there is no real problem of evil, when you started talking about those in power, everybody recognizes so clearly that power corrupts people, and that there are all sorts of greedy tendencies in members of our government, you would get them to acknowledge with no problem at all that there need to be restraints on those in power. So again, there is something to appeal to. But your question is a very important one, because what we have to realize is that not only is the capital going in more and more people, but in lots and lots of people, some of the interest is going too. Or it's been cut off from its source. And the work that we have to do as Christians is several fold. One is appealing to people about these gifts which have come from a Judeo-Christian worldview, helping people to see their importance. The second is rebuilding the foundation at the level of persuasion, of really teaching people in our society what is true, and pointing out that this is where these come from, that it is from that Judeo-Christian worldview that these notions arise. That's a very good question. The question is, well, what was Oz's position in particular on the Williamsburg Charter? Well, he was the director of it, basically. I've forgotten what his title was. But he is the person who worked full-time with others on its production. I mean, it's really something that he gave 3 years of his life to. Now, you've raised some very important questions. One of the things they were trying to do, and they are developing educational programs which are being taken up by many different states. One of them is to get people to recognize, and to get it to be recognized in the public school curriculum, that Christianity did indeed have a profound influence on the development of this culture. Because that is something that has been denied. There are many textbooks which have been written for school children which have left Christianity out completely. It was partly because some of the publishers, and Oz pointed this out, were afraid of being taken to court by the American Civil Liberties Union or other groups who don't have much interest in defending the influence of Christianity on this society. But there was a patch of several decades where Christianity wasn't mentioned at all in terms of the development of the institutions, of the moral values, of the legal structure of this society. And one of the effects of the Williamsburg Charter work is to get that reversed, to get people to acknowledge that this was indeed a historical reality, regardless of what they think about Christianity, this was a historical reality. The second element is this: does the fact that the Williamsburg Charter, or Oz, for example, or these school curriculums, speak about different religions, does this mean relativism? Does this mean the denial that there is truth? Or what? And Oz's reply to that would be no, that it's not a question of relativism at all. It's just simply a question of acknowledging that we live in a pluralist society. He gave the example, you can go to some schools where there will be, he gave Los Angeles as an example, where there may be 90 different religious positions represented in the student body. And evangelical Christianity may be a minority of those. Do we really believe in the separation of church and state? Do we think that on those children in the public school system, they should all be taught Christianity, not just that Christianity influenced the development of this culture, or should there be a recognition that in the student body and in the population as a whole there are indeed different religious positions, and that it's not the school's business to teach the Christian faith or the Islamic faith or humanism or Buddhism or Judaism or whatever else. Oz made one illustration. He said, you take a fundamentalist, for example, from Louisiana, who may be protesting about public education and the fact that his children are not being taught Christianity in the public schools. If he moves to Utah, his tune will change very rapidly, because he doesn't want his children taught Mormonism in the public schools. He will suddenly recognize that the separation of church and state and the removal of religion from the curriculum in terms of a religious perspective being taught as the truth, which will have to reflect the attitude of, let's say, in that case, the majority of the parents in the area, and if they're, the majority of them are Mormon, what do you do for the evangelical child who's there? Why should they be? What's important is to listen to Jewish people as well. They don't want a Christian position taught in the public schools. They would argue this is the responsibility of the parents to teach their children Christianity or Judaism or Mormonism or whatever. Now, that issue doesn't touch the question of what is true. The question is simply, is it the place of the public schools to be teaching in a pluralist society, which we have to acknowledge is pluralist, a particular conviction about who God is, who Christ is, who we are, what our dilemma is, and what the resolution to that is? And I would say from the British situation, one of the reasons for the great strength of American Christianity is the fact that that has not been seen to be the responsibility of the schools. Because in England, where I come from, where the church is a tiny minority, where we had an established church, we had and still have compulsory religious education in every state school. But it is worse than useless. It had the effect of inoculating all the children against Christianity. That was one of its consequences. The reason for that, it was simply this, that most of the people who taught it were not personally Christians. Consequently, what they taught had absolutely no conviction. I remember all the way through school, I grew up in a non-Christian family. I regarded it as the most boring lesson of the week. Everybody did. We hated having to take it. We all resented it. And it had the effect of us making us want never to think about the Bible or anything to do with Christianity. It was profoundly unhelpful. Oh, we may lament the fact that we're no longer living in a situation where Christianity is the consensus for the great majority of people. We may lament that. We ought to lament that. But we need to come to terms with the fact that we are actually living in a pluralist society. And acknowledging that is not the same as relativism. Being tolerant of other people's convictions is not the same as saying that they are true. So I must recognize, for example, that there are people on my street out in Bolwyn who are Jewish people. There are people who are Roman Catholics. There are people who are humanists. There are people who are into the New Age. There are people with all sorts of different convictions. There are probably people who are Muslims. Should I not tolerate the fact that they are there? Or their convictions? Of course I must. And I think there is something very fundamental here in terms of the nature of biblical Christianity itself, where God himself respects human significance. And God himself does not force people to be believers. He reasons with them. He seeks to persuade us and to convince us of what is true. And that is our challenge. And it is a real challenge before us, living in a pluralist society. But I think the last thing we want, I would say in America, is Christianity being taught in your public school system. Again, sometimes you would have Christians who were teaching it. And I remember one Christian who taught religion when I was in school in England. And his classes were different from everybody else's, but he was one among about 30 that I had during my years in school. And only one that really made any sense. And I could see really had some convictions about what he was teaching. But what has happened in England today is that the religious instruction has been forced to come to terms with the pluralistic nature of British society, and what's taught now is comparative religion. But nothing is true. And again, that one doesn't want that either. It's best to take it completely out of the public school situation and say it's the responsibility of parents to raise their children to know what is true, to love God and to serve him. And it's the responsibility of Christians to seek to persuade other people, children and adults in the society, that Christianity is true, but it isn't the responsibility of the schools. But I know it's a very touchy issue here. I mean, it's a very difficult one, but I would certainly say from the British perspective, don't hark to the answer that what we need is publicly legislated Christianity in the school system. It won't help. It will actually make the task of evangelism much more difficult. because people become hardened. That's certainly been the effect in Britain. And you always have to kind of take that into account when you're talking to somebody. Here is somebody who has a perception of Christianity shaped by what they heard in school. And somehow I've got to get through that and behind that and get back to the issue of what is true. That I'm not talking about something religious, I'm talking about truth. I'm not talking about something which is imposed on people against their will. I'm talking about something which by its truthfulness, by its power, by the beauty of its life, demands attention. But there are a lot, I mean, there's some very big questions there.